This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hi, my name is Paul McGuigan and I'm the director of a film called Lucky Number 11, and welcome to Mark Camone's podcast.
The movies coming up, Mark, will be what?
Well, Lucky Number 11, obviously, The Fog, Capote, and I'm already considering going to do the whole of the rest of the show, doing my impression of Philip Seymour Hoffman doing Capote, because...
No, we've
really
already
kind of
established
addictive.
That you and impressions are, frankly,
I'm sorry, I thought that was like Truman Capote was in the room with us.
Let's check it out. With a movie director, shall we?
You can ask who you want. It's, you know, in my head, it sounded fine.
Well, for me, it was shockingly terrible. Director Paul McGuigan joins us. His new thriller is Lucky Number 11, starring Josh Hartnett and Sir Ben Kingsley. Paul, nice to have you on the programme. Lucky Number 11 opens today. Just, well, this is easy for me to say and less easy for you to answer. Take us through the kind of rough idea of Lucky Number 11.
Okay, well, as you said, it's a very hard one to call, but I'll try my best. Josh Hartnett comes to New York to stay with his friend, who isn't there. When he gets to the apartment, he's not there. And then quickly, he is a victim of mistaken identity, and he's caught between the warring gangs in New York, Mr. Freeman and Sir Ben Kingsley, and... He's told that in order to cancel out a debt, he has to kill the fairy, who is the son of the rabbi, played by the aforementioned Kingsley, and then all fun starts.
Right.
And we can go on for another hour and a half if
sure.
you want.
So it's fair to say it's quite complex. You're going to have to sit and pay attention, aren't you?
I mean, that's the kind of fun of it. It's a film of language, and it's a film of, it's complex, and it's very different tonal shifts within the movie. And, it's a nice... It's one that certainly keeps you watching.
It's what is referred to as Rubik's Cube plotting, meaning, you know, you turn one bit and then the other bit goes sideways against it. And I have to say that, for me, it is the kind of movie that I think Guy Ritchie wished that he could have been making when he made... You know, Guy Ritchie says, oh, there's all these, you know, everyone's identity, their names, they all mean something. No, they mean absolutely nothing. And then you feel like you could take him to see, like, you go, Guy, see, there you go. It's like that. Only not like what you did.
Okay, is Usual Suspects an example of Rubik's Cube plotting?
Well, Usual Suspects is kind of the Citizen Kane, probably, of the genre, but it's kind of wrongly referred to, because Usual Suspects is a different kind of movie. I mean, I think the thing about Paul's movie, if I can speak for him, which obviously I can't because he directed it and I'm just the critic. See, I'm a really big fan of Gangster Number One, so I'm immediately predisposed to...
And of Paul Bettany.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Gangster One was the first time I ever saw Paul Bettany, and
you fell in love then?
I did, and we've had a lovely, fantastic relationship ever since then. But I remember when Gangster Number One came out, and Paul probably remembered this better than me, that some of the British critical response was positively hostile. I mean, there was some really grotesque stuff written about that film.
I mean, to be honest with you, if you don't mind me interrupting, Mark was the only... You wrote an article on Sight and Sound, which actually told the people this isn't a cheeky, chappy gangster movie. This is actually quite a serious look at a man who's insane, you know, who's breaking down and it's violent and, you know, you shouldn't take it for cheeky, chappy. I'm talking about Gangster Number One here.
Yeah, no,
and,
absolutely.
We were a victim of that kind of people getting very fed up with, and quite rightly so, of these kind of cheeky, chappy gangster films, you know.
And also, the thing with Gangster Number One is that although it was represented as being a fantastically violent movie, actually what you saw on screen in one key scene, for example, was actually the opposite of violence. It was all to do with implied violence. It was all to do with what was in your mind. And ever since then, I've held Paul McGuigan in very high regard as a director. I mean, obviously, stuff before that, Grand Star Cause, had given us, you know, indication of that talent. But I think, you know, for me, that was the defining moment.
Paul, how do you go about getting a cast? If you have a cast, as I mentioned, Josh Hartnett, Bruce Willis, Morgan Freeman, Ben Kingsley, feel free. Forgive me, not mentioning his knighthood every single time he gets a little tired. That, you know, people are going to go and see this on the basis of that star billing, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways of getting this kind of cast. You either pay for it or you have a good script, and we didn't have any money, so we had a script that people wanted to be a part of because it's the roles are very well defined. There's the rabbi, the boss, the hitman, the girl next door. The innocent, you know, it's quite a well-defined roles, and they're also very meaty roles. You know, people talk a lot in this movie. As I said before, a film of language, and I think that just attracts the best talent. And once one or two get involved, then they'll go, Morgan Freeman's in it. Okay, I'll do that, you know. I wish I could take any credit for it, but it's actually to do the script.
Now, Mark has this line which he trots out on a regular basis every time Ben Kingsley is in a movie.
Should we do it together?
No, it's your line. You can do it. And the line goes like this.
When he's good, he's very good. And when he's bad, he's Gandhi.
So... Right. In your opinion, Mark, which Ben Kingsley have we got in this movie?
Well, we're towards the good side of Kingsley. I mean, I have to say, in the screening that I saw of Lucky Number 7, which was just today, when the title Sir Ben Kingsley came up on screen, there's just a titter, because anyone in England seeing anyone referring to themselves as Sir just automatically engenders hostility, I think, in a British audience. But very soon that's forgotten about, because the fact is, he's a good character actor, and what he's given here is a character role to get his teeth into.
The fact is, of course, you're wrong about Gandhi. But anyway, Paul...
Oh, no, I'm right about Gandhi.
How do you direct someone with the pedigree of Ben Kingsley? Do you just let... I mean, we were talking about management in a sporting context. I know you're a big football fan. But we were talking about the difference that the new coach of the Scottish rugby team has made, and the art of man management. And, what is the art of actor management when you're a director?
You've got to understand, and I'm sure you do, that these actors see a lot of directors in their career, and I think that if you were going to be scared, or if you weren't going to be kind of quite clear about what you want, then they'll soon sniff it out, you know. And I don't think fear is really helpful. I think it's more like you do tend to direct in a different style. You do tend to direct more from the positive than from the negative. Because you are seeing such great performances, and then you have to suddenly snap yourself out a little bit and go, okay, I have to give some direction here. Because the worst direction you can give to an actor is, yeah, that was really good. Hey, can we do it again? You know, so I tend to just... I just do it the way I've always done it, really.
While Paul is throwing the credit for all this onto the actors, I would just like to turn this around the other way. I mean, I'd like to say that my response to Lucky Number 7 is, I think, you know, fine script, and, you know, all of those actors, they're all good, solid actors. You know, we know that anyway. I have to say, for me, the standout thing about the film is Paul's direction, because I think it's a very, very well-directed film. If I have the issues that I have with it at all are, you know, perhaps script issues, perhaps occasionally performance issues. Those things are all fine, and I think those are things that will make the movie popular, and certainly in terms of, you know, the poster looks like a great big sort of full-throated gangster action shoot-em-up. In fact, it's not that. Like the other of Paul's stuff, which I have liked, it has a very interesting use of music and images together. It's a much more melancholic film than perhaps I think the posters give it credit for. And I think the style, the personality of the film, I mean, I would say the star performance in that is it's a Paul McGuigan film rather than, you know, yes, Bruce Willis, fine. I mean, I know he can do that. Yes, Ben Kingsley, all that stuff. It's all fine. The script, fine. But I think your direction is the star of the film, Paul.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Paul, what would it take for you to do a movie in Scotland?
A good script again. You know, I mean, I've done things. When I was doing Wicker Park, I was shooting a little film for the BBC up in Newcastle, working with some heroin addicts and doing a thing called Little Angels, and actually we talked about it on your show. And so I just go where the best scripts are and the work that's interesting to me, you know. Everyone thinks you're off in Hollywood now and got your feet in a swimming pool, but, you know, I'm up here in Scotland and I'm out to go and pick up the kids from school. You know, it's the same deal as everyone else.
Because the reason I was going to start on this area of questioning, Duncan Kenworthy, president of BAFTA, has joined us. Hi, Duncan.
Hi.
And we got Paul McGuigan on.
Hi, Duncan.
Hi, Paul.
Because, Paul, you've made some comments in the past about funding and wondering whether bodies like Scottish Screen could actually do a whole lot more to attract people like you with a decent script to come. Is there something that BAFTA could do to make it easier?
I think we can always improve. You know, I think it's a step at a time. And I would just love to get more material, more scripts. I like the idea of mentoring. I think that for a film director or one who wants to be a film director or a writer, to actually be on a film set is one of the most useful things you can do, and sit and observe a director working and the problems and that he has to go through. You know, I think it's all this stuff is really helpful. As far as his BAFTA is concerned, I don't really have much to do with BAFTA, just because I'm up here in Scotland, and I think my first port of call was always Scottish Screen, you know.
Is it, in your opinion, still quite tricky to get a movie made here?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It has been hard for the past couple of years because of the financing situation. I've actually spent most of my time in Montreal shooting up there because it's cheaper than shooting in America. So they have the same problems as well. And then you go and you have to edit in Los Angeles. So I would rather be at home and working at home because I would like to be able to walk out the door in the morning and not have to say to my wife, right, I'll see you in 16 months, you know.
What do you make of that, Duncan?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that last sentiment. I mean, just on the mentoring, I think there is now a scheme called Guiding Lights.
Yes, yeah. I'm a part
of
that.
Which skill set? Yeah, no, I think 100 filmmakers are mentoring talent on their movies, and I think that's fantastic. I completely agree.
An interesting email from Steve in London. Could you ask Paul if it's true that he used to babysit Harry Potter?
my agent. Alan Radcliffe is obviously his father, so yeah, occasionally.
All right, so I was wondering what the connection was. So you actually used to babysit the actor who then became.
I didn't babysit. I mean, I was there at night when he was. I mean, his father
don't
was.
Spoil
my
the story,
agent.
Paul. Don't
okay,
spoil
yeah,
the story.
I babysat him, and there was funny things going on in his room. Strange lights yeah. coming from under the door.
And you made him what he is today.
Absolutely.
It was your agent gave up being an agent. To look
That's
after
right.
his son, who is now Harry Potter.
Yeah, well, you would, wouldn't
Thank
you?
Thank
okay. I'm losing the thread of this conversation completely.
Yes, I am too.
Paul, what are you working on next?
I'm looking at doing two other projects. I've just signed on for a remake of the 80s TV show, the Equalizer, the old Edward Woodward show.
Before my time, I think.
For Harvey Weinstein.
No, the Equalizer is not before your time. No, it's very famous.
It's before my time.
No, you've never seen the Equalizer.
I don't think I have.
The Equalizer TV show was really, actually, was really something. In fact, funnily enough, when we did the Wicker Man documentary, there was, with everyone, you had to spend 10 minutes just getting the Equalizer out of the way first. It's a very good TV show.
Hey, Paul, got an idea, though.
What's that?
Paul Bettany is the Equalizer. What do you think?
He would be very good. He always wears a good suit, Paul.
He does.
And Mark, I know he likes listening to you going on about him every week.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
well, we all love him.
It's a small elite club, isn't it?
Almost every movie he turns up in, he knocks the sort of the so-called star actor off the Russell Crowe, for example. seems to suffer by comparison. That's our conclusion. That's all.
He's extraordinary. He really is.
Hey, Paul, nice talking to you again. Thanks very much indeed for your time. All the best with Lucky Number 11. Movie conversation between now and 4 o'clock. Duncan Kenworthy is here, president of BAFTA. Have you just sort of come to, really, Duncan, after the weekend?
No, back to it the following morning. Well,
really?
Following afternoon. But no, it was a great night, Sunday night. We're still riding high on that, I think.
What did you make, quite uncalled for, in my opinion, the comments about Stephen Fry? I've always thought he's a fantastic host. I've always loved listening to him. I could, listen to him all night. Frankly, but he did get some criticism. Some people saying time for BAFTA to move on. He's lost it. And so what did you think?
I mean, I think every year Stephen says, oh, isn't it about time that I took a rest? And we've persuaded him each year, I think rightly, to continue on. I think he's brilliant myself. And I know from looking at other award shows that the hardest thing in the world is to find someone who can be funny, but not negative about the ceremony. You look at almost any other ceremony, they make fun of the sponsors, they make fun of the people who win, people who attend.
You're thinking of Jonathan Ross and people like that.
Well, I wouldn't use the JR analogy necessarily, but it is very, very hard. And Stephen somehow manages to find a way of being funny about himself or just cleverly about language. And instead of criticizing the people who've come all the way to give awards, he builds them up. I think it's great. I love that tone.
And I always think anyone who's watched the Oscars for any period of time at all and watched the way someone like Billy Crystal will present it and work the audience, you think, why can't we do that over here? And Stephen Fry is about as good as we've got, and it is an art. So I would like you to commit now publicly to rebooking him.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I mean, I think just for people who watch at home who don't see how the foreigners in the room react to Stephen, I have to say they absolutely love him. And I think a lot of the stars who come are coming because other stars who they know said from last year or the year before, Stephen Fry is absolutely brilliant. And James Seamus, you know, the producer of Brokeback, said to me, the day that you stop using Stephen is the day I'm going to stop coming to the BAFTAs.
There you go. Sorted. Mark, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting. This was the first time I ever went to the BAFTAs. I have recently become a member of BAFTA. I was lucky enough to go this time. And the thing that is most astonishing is just how, I mean, yes, the Americans and everything are entertained and they're amused. They're also, and this is what I love about it, genuinely shocked. Because the terrific thing about what Stephen Fry does is he says things that are potentially extremely, saucy in a way which is so plummy and so fantastically posh and cultured that the American, I mean, it's like he was making, gags about shaving and Heath Ledger and all this sort of stuff. And it's almost impossible to imagine another circumstance in which somebody could get away with that. I think that is a genuine national treasure. Mm. And I think that's what you would never get at the Oscars. What you get at the Oscars is people, doing gags about the films, doing gags about the stars. But it's all a very specific kind of humour. And you're literally seeing the Hollywood stars gasping with Stephen Fry getting away with some of this stuff because he does it in such a kind of, a posh and cultured and incredibly funny manner. I don't get it. Somebody just waved the newspaper at me and said, have you seen this stuff about... I hadn't seen it. I laughed all the way through the ceremony. You know that I can be rude about Stephen Fry because he made that film that I absolutely hated. But I think as a host, Bright Young Things, which I thought was rubbish. But I think as a host, he's matchless. And I thought he was really on top form. And I don't get what this fuss is about.
I had an email the next day from Los Angeles saying the BAFTA should be required viewing for all Oscars production staff.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. The same
all right, so that's sorted. Just on the other sort of issue of carping, which did turn up, the number of American nominations, Duncan, was it just the way it went this year, or is there a trend that's got you a bit worried?
No, not at all. I mean, I think people need to realise that it isn't a sort of smoke-filled room of men, middle-aged probably, white, sitting there going, who should we give the awards to this year? We are an academy of 6,000 members, all of whom have got to membership of the Academy because of what they've achieved. And they vote in the privacy of their own room. They choose the best work of the year. And so we take not the point of view necessarily of the industry, but we look at the point of view of the audience. What films are on British cinema screens in the previous year? And there are about 450 films. So to be one of the five nominees is a startling achievement. And to be a winner is, of course, amazing. So it's not unusual to have the winners not necessarily, or the nominees not necessarily be British, because that's not what they're judging. And I think it's slightly sort of misunderstanding or even demeaning to expect that just because people are British voters that they're going to vote for British work, whether it's the best or not.
This text from Ruth saying, Duncan produced one of my favourite films ever, which is Lawn Dogs. So I just wanted to say many thanks. I've been a lifelong Sam Rockwell fan ever since.
Well, that's fantastic. And did you see Misha Barton, who was the 10-year-old girl in that film, the star of that film, at the awards on Sunday night?
Did you? I didn't, actually. Did you, sitting there, Duncan, did you get the itch?
What itch is that?
Well, the itch to go out there, do some more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I've just about come to the end of my 2-year purdah at BAFTA, actually putting my all into BAFTA. Yeah, no, come July, I should be out of the door and back into the film world.
A Paul Bettany film, maybe?
He's very busy. Possibly.
Can I just interject on the subject of this complaints about, the Americans dominating the awards? The most important thing is this, and it's a very British thing to do. If Brits win big at the BAFTAs, then the press go, oh, well, it's because they're British awards. If the Americans win big at the BAFTAs, they go, where are all the Brits? It's like, it's the awards that are British, not the films. And it's a peculiarity of the British press that whichever way it goes, somebody has to have a snipe. The fact is that when you look at the nominations, the biggest nominated film was Constant Gardener. I'm no fan of Constant Gardener, but it got 10 nominations. That is a British film dominating the proceedings.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's, to take the Olympics, the current news, as an analogy, it's sort of like, we want the Olympics, we want everyone in the world to be eligible, but we only want the British to win. And if you imagine the Olympics with only British athletes, it's not the Olympics anymore. It's the British Sports Awards. So I think it honours the Brits more to judge them in competition with the best in the world. And then sometimes they win, and you go, like last year, Mike Leigh won Best Director with Martin Scorsese sitting in the audience. Can you imagine how Mike Leigh felt and what that says about his directing abilities? You know, if it was only if you had to have a British passport to be eligible, then it would become something else, and it's not that.
Philip Beale on this email says, Stephen Fry was brilliant yet again this year. Most presenters and hosts can only dream of having an ounce of his grace and wit. Book him again. He's the only reason I watch the show. And I think we've already sorted that out.
I think Stephen's price is going up minute by minute.
Well, Brooke, no criticism or comment to the detriment of Mr. Fry. Duncan, always nice to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Always a pleasure.
May have a more relaxing weekend than you did last time.
Thank you
last
very much.
Duncan Kenworthy, president of BAFTA. Thanks for all the emails. We'll work through as many as we possibly can. People still want to have a go at this this quiz, which they're coming up with all kinds of extra, different, more complicated versions of. If there's time, we'll do them before four. Let's do the box office top 10. At 10, Brokeback Mountain.
Still great, still in its way. And as James Seamus pointed out at that award ceremony, it's not a gay cowboy movie, and you should have loved this. It's a gay shepherd movie.
He did that gag?
He actually did. He did your gag.
It was sent in by a listener.
Well, there we go. James Seamus, the producer of Brokeback Mountain, did the gag. He said, I want to clear this up once and for all. We've got rid of that silly gay cowboy tactic. It's a universal love story about gay shepherds. And I thought, standing up, shouting, Mayo!
That would have been very embarrassing.
Yeah, I didn't.
And you'll never be invited ever again. Munich at 9. Good night and good luck at 8.
Very good. Very talky, some people think, but I think talking about interesting subjects and, you know, well-directed, well-played. Again, an understated performance from Robert Downey Jr., which I am going to have to completely change my view of him. And if you're interested in McCarthy, which I am, particularly interesting. If you're not interested in McCarthy, then, you know, go along and see it on the basis of Gorgeous George and then be surprised at what you learn.
Zathura, a space adventure at 7.
You know, I've had to revise my view of this slightly since I took my kids to see it, and I now have to do it with the proviso that it is a bit scary, that the Zorgons are scarier than I thought, but otherwise it's Jumanji in space, but younger children may find the Zorgons a bit scary.
Eon Flux at 6.
Nothing like as bad as the critics say. I'm obviously taking happy pills at the moment. I thought Eon Flux was... I mean, it's rubbish. In the future, the world will be terrible, but it's okay because everyone will, you know, dress in exotic fetish gear. Well, fine. Bring it on.
Casanova at 5.
No good at all. Don't understand it. I mean, Heath Ledger's a perfectly fine actor and he's soft-peddling here. Omid Djalili steals every single scene that he's in and he's very, very good. And Sienna Miller, it's like... There's a hat stand in the middle of... Oh, no, sorry, that's her. Sorry.
This week's number 4 is Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic by the soundtrack, because it's rather splendid.
Yeah, it's very good. I think we've covered it in great detail. If you haven't seen it yet, what are you doing with your life?
Final Destination 3 at 3.
Surprisingly, and not a bad movie at all. I mean, obviously stupid, dumb, dunderheaded and slightly sadistic, but in a good way. And, you know, zips past at 90 minutes long. The roller coaster opening, which some people have said isn't as good as the plane and the coach and all the other... I thought the roller coaster ending was good, and I thought that the catalogue of cruelty was actually quite exciting. Excitingly executed.
Strange man you are. Ken, on this email, saw Final Destination 3 last weekend. Total trashy rubbish, but quite enjoyable. Looking forward to Capote this weekend and wondered if you're looking forward to The Hills Have Eyes remake.
Well, Alan Jones...
Why bother?
Alan Jones has seen it and says that it's actually pretty good, but I'm slightly anxious about it. I haven't seen it yet.
So Final Destination at three, and Big Mama's House 2 at 2.
Not funny the first time round, not funny the second time round, probably won't be funny the third time round, and I'm almost certain that they'll do it a third time round.
What a shame Fun with Dick and Jane isn't in, so
I know,
do that gag. Anyway, Chicken Little 1 is at 1.
Well... The verdict for me, you know, waving thumb, bit of a mess, all over the place, War of the Worlds turns into cartoon. The verdict from the kids, major thumbs up! It's just a whole bunch of stuff exploding and chickens farting.
So that's it.
Hey.
Is that your impression of an eight-year-old?
Not eight, four, five.
Declan McCafferty says... I've always enjoyed this part of the programme. The rest of it is rubbish. Yeah. Since I discovered it, I usually found myself shouting slightly less throughout the week. The show serves a useful purpose. I'm getting confused already.
Yeah, he meets you.
Here's one of those, he says, admittedly now rather tired, guess that film things that perhaps a man with a PhD in horror could get. Stonehenge Theft, Flashing Pumpkins, Everybody Dies.
Stonehenge Theft?
Stonehenge Theft, Flashing Pumpkins, Everybody dies.
Is it like Halloween 3 Season of the Witch?
It is exactly Halloween
3. Oh, there you go. Look at that.
Declan says, thanks and apologies for mentioning Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. Okay, so that's not a, you're off to a flyer. First review up, I would imagine, is Capote, which is the most talked about movie of the week. And get the comments.
And are we going to be doing it like this?
No, you're not. No, or you'll have to leave. Callum in Portsmouth. Mark saw Walk the Line after I downloaded your glowing review. I liked it, but I didn't think Phoenix was nearly as good as Jamie Foxx in Ray and won't win the Oscar because of that. But a very good film.
He won't win it because Philip Seymour Hoffman's going to win it.
Jimmy Buzzard says, saw Ian Flux last Wednesday. What a load of fetid dingo's kidneys. But to be fair, Charlie's leather-clad rear was worth a fiver by any standard.
Exactly, there we go.
Howie says, for the sake of a £10 bet between me and my daughter, could you ask Mark if the American actor in the cinema ad for a well-known mobile phone company offering reduced price tickets is Kevin Spacey? I say it is. My daughter says it isn't.
It isn't.
It does look like.
Yeah, but it isn't.
Momentarily, you think
it
might
isn't.
Be. So daughter wins.
Daughter wins, yes.
A lot dad knows. Here's one for Mark, says Martin in Manchester. Egocentric, whining, manipulative, whining, self-serving, whining, self-pitying, whining, extremely annoying for 2 hours, whining. Oscar? Most definitely.
Well, it's probably Gwyneth Paltrow in Proof, but she's not nominated.
No, I'm teeing up your next review.
Oh, I see, fine. Is it Capote?
The answer is Capote.
Oh, fine,
Martin says, by the way, Philip Seymour Hoffman is great. It's just Capote I hate it.
Yeah, no, that's... okay, fine. And that is a perfect lead into the movie. First thing to say about it, if you looked at the posters, there's a fantastic misprint on the posters. It says, winner, Philip Seymour Hoffman, winner of the Golden Globe Award Best Actor, brackets, musical or comedy. Believe me, if you go and see Capote waiting for either the gags or the songs to start, you're going to be sorely disappointed. He didn't win in the musical comedy category. He won in the dramatic category, you dimwits. So it's neither a musical nor a comedy. It is an anti-biopic of the extremely annoying Truman Capote. If you don't know, but I imagine most people do, Truman Capote was a journalist, and he went in 1959 to cover a murder in Kansas in which a family had been killed fairly, completely senselessly, as far as anyone could tell. Very swiftly, they caught the killers. Truman Capote then decided that he was going to write a non-fiction novel about the killing. And he then developed a relationship with the killers, which was very peculiar in that he kind of sort of fell in love with one of them virtually. And then as the case went on and as the appeals went on and as they kept not getting executed, became more and more frustrated by the fact that he couldn't finish his book until their story finished. And it's a classic case of a journalist inveigling himself into people's confidences for reasons which are far from pure. His performance is brilliant, and I'm pretty certain that he will win the Oscar for Best Actor, and deservedly so. I mean, he's completely reshaped himself to do it, because Capote was a fairly slight man, and I think his performance is really terrific. But what's fantastic about Capote is that it's as if Philip Seymour Hoffman has completely immersed himself in the character of Capote. But the movie is made by people who seem to be completely alienated from Capote, by Bennett Miller, the director, and Dan Futterman, the screenwriter. Now, when I first saw it, the thing that I was immediately reminded of was, there's a very famous article by Janet Malcolm called The Journalist and the Murderer. And she wrote this article about, to cut a very long story short, a guy was convicted of murder. An American journalist inveigled his way into his confidence whilst the trial was on, said, I'm going to write your story. And what he actually did was he thought the guy that he was writing the story of was guilty. When the guy was found guilty, this bloke then wrote a book saying, I always knew he was guilty, he was terribly guilty. The murderer then sued the journalist for saying, well, I may be a convicted killer, but you're libeling, you're bad-mouthing me. That journalist then went to Janet Malcolm and said, oh, it's terrible, I'm being done the dirty on by this murderer who's suing me. Janet Malcolm then wrote a piece about that journalist saying, actually, the journalist is wrong. The point of the article was, what Janet Malcolm said was, never trust a journalist. Never trust a journalist's relationship with their subject, because in the end, all they're interested in is themselves. Now, when I saw Capote, that was what was in my mind. I was thrilled a little later on to read an interview with Dan Futterman in which he himself cited Janet Malcolm's The Journalist and the Murderer. And if you haven't read The Journalist and the Murderer, go and read it. It's only about 100 pages long. It's an absolutely blistering essay on the relationship between journalism and true crime novel writing. And now, I am particularly interested in this subject. So from 5 minutes into the film, I was just there. I thought, how terrific to see a movie which is not a biopic that loves its subject. It's a biopic that has a distance from its subject. Actually, the subject isn't the centre of the film. It's not really about Capote. It's really about this terrible relationship in which a journalist would effectively lie to somebody. There's a marvellous moment when one of the criminals is in jail. He says to Capote, "What are you going to call the book?" And Capote says, "Well, I haven't decided what I'm going to call it. I haven't thought of a title." And he's already decided he's going to call it In Cold Blood. Then when they keep getting stays of execution, we see Capote getting really, really bothered because I can't finish my book until it's almost like he no longer has any morality left. And of course, the sucker punch of the story is that after the killers were executed, and if you've seen the film, the Richard Brooks film of In Cold Blood, you'll know the story of that. And that's, incidentally, a very interesting film. It was all filmed in the actual locations, right down to the Clutter House where the original murders happened. Capote never finished another substantial work afterwards. It was almost like doing In Cold Blood finished him off as well. So
even though he lived for quite a long
time. He was a celebrated New York socialite, and he was a celebrated, but he never finished another great work. It was like that was the work that he had in him. And I think the real triumph of Capote the movie is that it manages to get right inside its central subject, but also to stand back, to be completely objective about what he did, about his methods. It doesn't paint him as a complete villain, but what it does is it takes a really interesting look at the way in which journalism is essentially duplicitous in this area. It has a fantastic supporting performance from Catherine Keener, who is, in almost everything she's in, she's flawless. And in this, it's another understated role as Harper Lee. You know, she goes off and she writes To Kill a Mockingbird whilst Capote is doing this. She writes To Kill a Mockingbird. It's published. It comes out as a film. But Capote doesn't see any of it because all he sees is his own pain and the fact that he can't get his book finished. And all through it, Philip Seymour Hoffman never makes you want to do the thing which me just doing that for 10 seconds makes you want to do, which is to go, "I'm sorry, I can't stand this anymore. If you do that again, I'm going to slap you." So I think I really think it's something. Obviously, I have a particular interest in this subject because my PhD was on horror fiction, and one whole section on it was about true crime novels, everything from In Cold Blood through the Moore's Murders books, Beyond Belief, and onto Gordon Byrne, Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son. So this is a subject I'm very interested in. And if you are interested in that and the duplicitousness of journalism, you will sit there watching Capote thinking, this is like being in a university lecture, only fun. But if you're not interested in that stuff, and I think a lot of people will just go for this, just go for that barnstorming central performance. Honestly, there's much more going on in it than that. I know that his performance is the thing which is dominating the reviews, but there is so much more substance. And hats off to Bennett Miller and Dan Futterman for pulling it off, because they've done a bravura job. And when you've seen the movie and when you've enjoyed it, go and get Janet Malcolm's The Journalist and the Murderer and read it.
So never trust a journalist.
No.
Unless he's played by George Clooney, which is a
exactly, which is a complete,
A slightly different take on what journalism does or could do.
What Malcolm was specifically saying was, it's journalists reporting interviews. Okay, a journalist talking to you is one thing, but a journalist interviewing you, I mean, this must have happened to you. You've been interviewed by a journalist, and the journalist has then written up the interview, and what you read isn't, I mean, it's kind of what you said, but it's not quite what you said.
Print journalists can always put their spin on something, hence the advantage of doing them here, where people hear exactly what people are saying.
The great joy of live radio is that it's impossible to do that. But in print journalism, and this is what Janet Malcolm is saying in The Journalist and the Murderer, and of course she herself has been accused of doing it, and this is what happened with Capote. It's, in the end, it's their story that they're telling. And that's the central heart of Capote. I know it sounds esoteric. I know it sounds, hyper... highfalutin and intellectual, the rest of it. It really isn't. The brilliance of the film is that you almost don't notice the depths of the subjects that it's addressing.
A number of people, particularly Oliver in Tooting, suggesting that that Truman Capote voice sounds more like Michael Jackson.
But mine or his?
Well, I don't know. Well, I think both. Your version of it and then hearing that kind of horrible, whiny voice, which is even worse than yours.
That was somebody else that you were doing then. Do it again.
No, I looked like them at the same time. It's a very disturbing impression.
Okay.
Stuart, I remember watching the Oscar, but this is from Stuart, it's not addressing you, Stuart. The Oscar build up, the year Will Smith was up for Best Male for his performance of Ali. The big reason given at the time for not winning was that his performance was more impersonation instead of acting. Yeah. How come then Jamie Foxx has won Impersonating Ray? And again, this year both Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman are expected to do well for their impersonations. Can you clear this up for me? By the way, love the podcast so much. Today's the first time I've listened live.
I can clear it up. Basically, when people say it's an impersonation rather than a performance, they mean it in a derogatory fashion. But obviously, there really isn't much difference. It's a sort of critical shorthand and a flip, glib critical shorthand, and then a way of dismissing a performance that sort of looks like someone doing an impression. They always say, oh, it's like John Coleshaw doing it. Like, that's an easy thing to do. But you're quite right. And incidentally, Will Smith's performance in Ali was hugely underrated. I thought Ali was... Didn't we do screenings of Ali?
I think we did.
Yeah, it was a very underrated film. And I think it bespeaks an ignorance in
it
the...
It bespeaks?
Oh, don't start again about that.
Well, you stop using the word then.
I'm not going to stop using it. I've used it since I was... You know, it's an old word. It's in the English language.
It's an affectation. What else is new?
Well, shall we quickly do Lucky Number 11?
Go on then.
You're just...
What does that bespeak of? Thing. Lucky Number 7 bespeaks of a Rubik's
Cube. You can't
cube
do it because you're just common.
Okay. You revealed an awful lot there.
Lucky Number 11, new movie by Paul McGuigan, who was on the show. Because we've kind of talked about it already, and we're slightly short of time. To do the downside first, it's, you know, in the end, it's flippant and superficial in its plotting to some extent, and the performances are actually, you know, pretty okay, with the exception occasionally of Ben Kingsley, who chews the scenery a little bit too much, but only a little bit too much. I'm somebody who's very reserved about Ben Kingsley. He's fine. It's a character role, and he does it characterfully, although, as I said, there were titters in the cinema when the title came up, Sir Ben Kingsley. But I think what you have here is something that, although Paul McGuigan was saying the thing was it's great actors and a great script, I think it's the opposite. I think it's fine actors and an okay script. But it's lent an edge by his direction. I do think he's a very good director. I think he has a very good eye. I think there is depth to his work that you don't see on the outside. They all look more flippant than they actually are. Gangster Number One is a much deeper film than people gave it credit for, and I think now when people go back and look at it, they see the same thing. You are not going to go back to Lucky Number 11 and see a work of great profundity, but... It because in the end, it is a twisty thriller. I said it's like this Rubik's Cube plotting thing. Can you guess the twist? Compare it, however, to something like Guy Ritchie's Revolver, which thinks that it's this intelligent movie. And it's, in fact, the dumbest, stupidest, most fatuous, empty-headed load of old nonsense on the planet. Incidentally, coming out on DVD next week with a director commentary, which I'm going to listen to over the weekend because I can't wait to see how Guy explains himself away on that commentary
track.
It'd
be great to watch that with him speaking in your ear, wouldn't it? It would be irritating.
Well, after he came on the programme and did
He did explain.
Did he? Insert unrepeatable here.
He did, and then people got confused. They were more confused after his explanation.
He's an idiot. I'm sorry. There we go. Paul McGuigan is actually a very interesting director. If I have a criticism of the movie, it's that the other things aren't quite on the same level as he is. I've seen a lot of two-star reviews for the film today, people saying it's empty, it's flippant, it's vacuous. And I think what they're missing is that they're seeing his style and therefore thinking that there's nothing other than style in it. I happen to be of the opinion that he's much more than just a stylist. I think that he's got a great movie in him somewhere. This isn't it, but it was... There's enough in it to make me pleased to have seen it and to make me think that at some point he's going to hit the nail right on the head again like he did with Gangster Number One. Also out this week, The Fog.
Not John Carpenter's The Fog.
No, you're right, not John Carpenter's The Fog.
Well, that wasn't that good in the first
place. No, The Fog the first time round was dull, right? Here's a film, right?
That's the one where the fog comes in.
The fog comes in.
And there's a guy in the lighthouse running a radio station, yeah. And then sort of dead sailors come and kill people.
Adrienne Barbeau in the original, replaced here by, what's she called? Can't remember the woman's name. Selma Blair. So it's all the stuff of the original. Fog comes in, village beset by ghosties, creepies, ancient evil, ancient wrong being put right. Fine. Remade. The bits that are good are the bits that were exactly the same as they were the first time round. Most of the bits that are bad are the fact that you go, well, that's Selma Blair and not Adrienne Barbeau, and why am I bothering with this? When the ghosties and ghoulies turn up, they appear to have walked off the ship from Pirates of the Caribbean because they're done by exactly the same special effects technique. So immediately I start thinking about Gore Verbinski, and that puts me off.
Why does that put you off?
Because Gore Verbinski's an idiot. He can't direct. He's a fool.
That's two people you've just called.
Well, I'm sorry. And,
minutes.
If either Guy Ritchie or Gore Verbinski...
What happened to those happy tablets you were taking?
Well, I'm happy. I'm very, very happy about
that. Be positive about him.
The BBFC certificate says, contains moderate horror and violence. Well, I was never moderately horrified, but I did feel violent. So, true on that basis.
Just make you wonder, why would you bother to remake John... I mean, it wasn't even the best John Carpenter.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I like John Carpenter, and it's The Fog is the one that you kind of overlook, because it's not very good. It's a bit dull. There's a great bit at the beginning, And then there's a whole bunch of stuff with people running away from fog. The difference, of course, is that when Carpenter did it, he did fog with fog. I mean, they used mole foggers. That's how you make fog. You get a mole fogger and you pump it and fog comes out the end of it.
What's a mole fogger?
It's a fog machine that's invented by a guy called Mr. Mole.
Oh, I see. How prosaic.
Yes, exactly. It's called a mole fogger. And that's how you make fog. Well, now, of course, what you do is you go to your special CGI guys and you say, I would like you to conjure up some CGI fog for me, please. So the fog, it was boring the first time round. It's completely rubbish the second time round. This remake is directed by Rupert Wainwright, who directed Stigmata. And what an absolute stinker of a film that was. Well,
Is he an idiot as well?
He is an idiot. Yeah, that's three idiots. But not as much of an idiot as the idiots behind Date Movie. Okay, Date Movie, which is just what we needed, a spoof of Date Movies from 2/6 of the creators of the Scary Movie series. And that gag is the best gag in the film, and it's not in the film, it's on the poster. Alison Harrigan, who is quite funny in those American Pie movies, and actually is probably quite clearly a talented comedian.
She's an idiot, I think.
No, she's not an idiot.
Oh, she's not.
No, she's not. She's not. She's fine. Stars in a spoof of romantic comedies. Now, here's the big problem. The way a spoof movie works is you take a serious movie and you make jokes about it. That's why all those airplane movies were really funny. Take all the serious movies, like the airport movies and the Poseidon Adventure and the Towering Inferno, and you make them funny. What Date Movie and Scary Movie did is take movies like Napoleon Dynamite, My Big Fat Wedding, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Shallow Hal, Hitch. What have all these films got? They were funny the first time round, and then they do bits from them, only without the jokes. The tagline on the poster is, everyone wants a happy ending, and I was very happy when it ended. And that's a better joke than any of the jokes that are in Date Movie.
And it was a rubbish joke anyway.
Yeah. But I can do it as Truman Capote.
So Fog or Date Movie for Movie of the Week, would you think?
Well, you know...
if you had to choose.
Either of them?
Yeah.
Oh. The Fog, I think, is slightly shorter.
OK, fine. But apart from that, Movie of the Week.
Capote. But do give Lucky Number Slavin a look and don't be put off by the snotty broadsheets being snotty about it.
Yeah, they're idiots anyway.